or that level of expectation, you'll always fall short of your own potential. Any achievement will be the minimum expected of you, considering the circumstances, and any failure will be purely due to character weakness. To be clear, I personally think Charles is doing really well. He's got a lovely place here, seems like a lovely job. I'd be a proud mother. That's another thing about private school boys. They tug at the heartstrings, don't they? They bypass the sexual and hotline the maternal. They never grow up. I pop the diamond pouch out of my coat pocket and onto the desktop. The stones are now safely stored away in the soft cream leather wallet that Mark and I purchased for the purpose. The plastic baggie was not appropriate. And though the pouch set us back £150, it gives a wholly different tone to the current endeavor. Charles clicks to attention. It's the reason he's here, after all, and it has been a bad year. I explain that the family I work for is looking to liquidate some assets over the next few months. The stones will be the initial sale to test the waters, to see how receptive the market is at the moment. Of course, in reality, there are no other assets. I wish there were. I wish we'd found more bags. But I figure the prospect of more sales to come for Charles will, A, get us the best price for the stones today, and B, lessen the suspicious nature of a one-off sale. Charles's interest is piqued. I knew the leather pouch was worth it. He fetches a jewelry tray. I pass him the pouch. I want him to pour it out himself. To have the feeling I had the first time I saw hundreds of diamond pills pour out into the refracting light. He shakes the pouch gently, and they tumble out onto the green felt tray. He feels it. The hairs on the back of my arms rise. I feel it. Opportunity. Possibility. He moistens his lips before he looks up. Very nice. Lovely. A hint of joy bubbles just under the surface of his deadpan expression. He's no poker player, that's for sure. A rate of 10% commission is agreed upon. He'll get started as soon as I leave and should have some offers by the afternoon. Things move very fast in the diamond market. He can have a sale agreed by the end of the day if that's something the family I work for would be interested in. I leave with a handwritten receipt in lieu of the stones and head back to the cafe to meet Mark. And then I feel it. Eyes on my back. I stop on the corner of Pall Mall and St. James Street, and with nerves fizzing, pretend to look for my phone in my bag. Two men behind me pass by. They're not police, and they aren't following me. They're just two well-dressed men on their way to a long lunch. I check over my shoulder, back all the way down the mall to Trafalgar Square, my eyes searching for DCI Foster's stocky frame amongst the few pedestrians. Of the 20 or so passers-by, no one fits the bill. DCI Foster's not here. He's not watching me. Stop it, Erin, don't be paranoid. My heart flutters in my chest, a ghost instinct, nothing more. I head off up St. James to meet Mark. He lights up when he sees me enter. He wants to know how it went with Charles. Very, very good, I assure him. He's looking for buyers as we speak. He's really excited. He was trying to hide it, but I could tell. This might be done in a couple of hours. He's going to call me this afternoon with some offers. My hands are shaking ever so slightly. Mark slides his hand over the cafe table and rests his palm over mine. You're doing really well, honey. I'm impressed. He undercuts it with a grin. I can't help breaking into one too. What are we doing? It's scary, but it's also completely thrilling. I can't speak for Mark, obviously, but I've only ever got the occasional parking ticket before now. I'm not a criminal. But it's amazing how smoothly we're taking to all this. I console myself that it's okay to be paranoid every now and then. It'd be crazy if I weren't, considering what we're doing. We've brought all this danger home with us, to England. Listen, Erin, honey. Why don't we just stay in town and wait for Charles's call together? And if an offer comes through, we'll just take it, okay? And you can pop back down there and do the deal, and we can be completely done by this afternoon. Diamonds out of the house. Done. We can go back to our normal lives. Well, normal-ish. That smile again. My mobile rings at around 1:30. It's Charles, calling back already. I recognized the final three digits from Mark's call this morning. Mark gives me the nod and I answer after four rings. We don't want to sound too desperate. Hello? I answer briskly. Sarah, my imaginary PA character, has much more important things to be getting on with than waiting for Charles's call.
Hello there, Sarah. It's Charles from Naaman Sardi.
He's tentative. Oh, fantastic. Hello, Charles. What can I do for you? I sound breezy, aloof, and professional. Mark catches my eye and smiles. He likes this character. Very sexy. Charles hesitates again, ever so slightly, but I catch it. An infinitesimal pause down the line before he plunges in.
Sarah, I'm ever so sorry, but unfortunately I'm not going to be able to help with this. As much as I'd love to, I'll have to sit this one out, I'm afraid.
My stomach flips, and my eyes dart to Mark. He's already caught the change in energy from me, and he quietly scans the faces in the cafe. Are we busted? Is it finished? I've been silent a beat too long on the phone. I focus and continue calmly. Is there some sort of problem, Charles? I manage to sound slightly passive-aggressive. Sarah isn't sure why Charles has been wasting her goddamn time if he isn't capable of selling diamonds. Mark's eyes are on me again.
I'm terribly sorry, Sarah. It's just a small issue of provenance, that's all. I'm sure you can understand. I'm embarrassed to mention it, really. I'm certain your clients are unaware that they are in possession of... Well, needless to say, there have been quite a few red flags regarding the provenance of the stones, which may cause potential problems further down the line. So I'm going to have to bow out at this stage. I'm sure you understand.
Charles leaves a silence for me to fill. I shake my head at Mark. No sale. Provenance? I frown. And then I get it. Charles is letting me know that he thinks we're dealing with blood diamonds, that our stones come from some ethical void or other in Africa. Of course, with no papers, no trail, that's what they must look like. And I'd rather Charles thinks they're blood diamonds than that their lack of provenance is due to the fact that we simply stole them. Of course, he must have suspected something was off when I handed them over, but I'd wager his concerns are more to do with potential heat than ethics. If he'd been able to offload the stones to literally anyone over the past few hours, I'm guessing he'd have done it. I don't blame him for bulking. If I were Charles, I'd run a mile, especially if he's having a bad year. People like Charles don't last long in prison. I see. Well, thank you, Charles. That's all extremely helpful. I'm sure my clients will be very interested to hear that. You're correct in assuming that they would be completely unaware of any complications of that nature. So, thank you for your discretion. I oil him. I know he's not going to tell anyone, but he's worth greasing if it makes life easier.
Not a problem at all, Sarah.
I hear a relieved smile in his voice.
Could I ask, though, that you inform your clients that I'm very happy to look into any other assets they'd be interested in liquidating? I'm happy to be of use if they need me for anything else. You do have my details, don't you?
He wants the spoils, but he doesn't want to get his hands dirty. Join the queue, Charles. Join the queue. Yes, of course, and I know they'll appreciate your discretion in this matter, I say. Mark shakes his head. I'm smoothing the ego of a man who just told us we're criminals, and it's working. People are strange, aren't they?
Wonderful, many thanks. Oh, Sarah, would you mind awfully collecting them from my office now? I'll have them bagged and ready. It's probably best.
I hang up and slump onto the cafe table. God, being a criminal is exhausting. Mark ruffles my hair and I raise my eyes slowly to him. No sale. I keep my tone hushed. He thinks they're blood diamonds. He's fine, though. No intention of telling. I've got to go get them back now. Damn it. It's not what Mark wanted to hear. He put a lot of work into smoothing that transaction. This part was supposed to be the easy part. He doesn't know it's us selling, does he? No, I reply quickly. There's no way he could know. And if he does, he's definitely not the kind to ever mention it. I'm sure people bring him all sorts. Blood diamonds are probably the least of his worries. If he's too scared to try and sell the diamonds for us, then he'll definitely be too scared to shoot his mouth off about them. Who knows who my clients could be? Who knows what they might be capable of? I'm not concerned in the least about Charles ratting on us. Mark's frown fades, and he flashes me a little smile. So, what the hell are we going to do now? He says it lightly. the absurdity of our situation evident in his tone. Because what are we going to do now? We don't know anyone else. We don't know how to sell diamonds. I let out a giggle. He grins back, eyes crinkling around the edges. God, he's gorgeous. I really thought that Charles was it. I half expected him to make an offer on the spot, I say. God, why can't it just be that easy? I kind of thought it would be too. Switzerland spoiled us, I think. That went almost too smoothly. We're going to have to look down other avenues for these, though. We're not done yet. I'll get on it now. You go get the stones back. He nods towards the door. I leave Mark brainstorming while I head back to Charles's office to pick up our diamonds, and suddenly this feels fun again. I could do this forever with Mark, a daisy to his Gatsby. When I get back to the gallery, Charles isn't there. A security guard answers the bell and hands me the offending pouch in exchange for Charles's receipt. It seems Charles wants to cover his bases, distance himself. Mark will have to feign ignorance of the whole thing if he ever meets Victoria again. Act shocked and dismayed that his contact was trying to offload blood diamonds. Who knew? It's perfectly plausible. Mark's been far enough away from the action to plead ignorance, and there are a lot of bad rich people out there. Aside from being my husband, Mark has no tangible connection to anything that just happened. But then, I wasn't here either. Sarah was. A flicker of a voice in my head reminds me that I consistently am the one closest to all this, in terms of traceability, if it all goes sour. I am the one on CCTV in Switzerland. I am the one on CCTV in Pall Mall. Not my name, but my face. As I walk back with the stones to meet Mark, I wonder, was this my idea, to get so close? Or did I just fall into my role? Am I braver, more adept than Mark? Or am I stupider? Why is it always me? But then, Mark's the one with the contacts, so he can't do the transactions, can he? It does make sense. And to be honest, I don't like taking the back seat on things. We're actually a perfect team. Mark's fresh out of diamond ideas when I get back, so we decide to call it a day. His brain seems to have shifted back to business concerns now. He has to meet another old work friend this afternoon, about financial regulation in private consultancy. Setting up the new business is going to mean jumping through a lot of hoops. I tell him to go. We really need more time to think about our next move with the diamonds anyway. I kiss him goodbye and head back home. The diamonds cocooned inside their buttery leather and my cold pocketed hand. It's while I'm walking back to the tube that the idea comes to me. So, if slow-moving Charles can sell diamonds, why can't we do it ourselves? Charles is a middleman, someone who takes the things very rich people don't want anymore and finds other people to buy those things. He trades with other people's money. If Charles can pick up the basics of trading assets alongside his BA in fine art, I'm sure it's not rocket science, like Mark used to do in the city, but Charles does it on a much smaller scale. And we've certainly bought diamonds before. We know our four C's from all the extensive diamond searching we did together after our engagement. We know approximately how much these stones are worth, so we just need to find someone willing to buy them. And fancy that, there's a whole street in London entirely devoted to buying and selling diamonds. We just need someone who isn't too concerned about provenance to show an interest. Someone a little more, shall we say, proactive than Charles. We can at least test the waters. I dip into an alleyway off Piccadilly, shake one fat diamond out into my palm and pocket the rest. At Farringdon Station, I walk up through the warren of side streets into busy Hatton Garden. It's cold today, with a fierce, sharp wind. The road is bustling with Hasidic Jews, hands holding down their wide-brimmed hats against the wind, and moneyed cockney traders muffled to the chin in cashmere coats, all in a hurry to get somewhere. It's probably a stupid idea, coming here, but again, I don't exactly look like a jewel thief, do I? Why would a well-dressed woman in her early 30s draw attention by having a diamond valued in Hatton Garden? People do it every day. I look down at my engagement ring. It's beautiful. Mark did spend too much on it, really. It's easy to see that now. But at the time, I remember thinking how much he loved me, how much he'd sacrificed to buy it, the hours he'd worked for it, how beautiful it is, how sparkly. Now I see a trophy, a game head. Mark's hard work mounted on my finger. If we needed the money, I would have sold it in a heartbeat for us, for our house, for our baby. The thin gold band beneath it means more than the sparkle above. But after the bag, I won't ever need to do that. And I suppose if I manage to sell the stones, there'll never be any need for me to sell anything again. I try the open-fronted diamond exchange market first. It's a cavernous space filled with many different store counters, different traders specializing in different gems and metals. Orthodox Jews sit leaning over counters next to sharp-suited Cockney traders, a smorgasbord of family businesses cheek to cheek. I don't get far before a trader motions me over. Although no one appears to be looking at me, I know I'm a fox that's just wandered into a hunt. "What are you after, darling?" He's bald, Cockney, shirt, tie, fleece, practical, a man who dresses for the weather. He's got a friendly enough smile. He'll do. "I'm looking to sell, actually. I've got a 2-carat stone, used to be an engagement ring." I figure that's a fairly foolproof story. No one's going to ask whose engagement ring, are they? I mean, logically, whoever once owned it is either dead or not married anymore. Not the kind of sales patter anyone wants. Not that useful in oiling the cogs of commerce. The fact that the stone is not in a ring anymore is fairly ominous too. Ominous enough that it would be inappropriate to ask. Well, here's hoping. I came up with my story on the tube. I think it's pretty good. 2-carat, lovely. Let's have a look then. He's genuinely excited. I guess it's the kind of job where you never know from day to day what might turn up. Something about his expression as I fish the single stone out of my pocket reminds me of that famous episode of Only Fools and Horses. You know, the one where Del and Rodney find the watch and they finally become millionaires. He's bought my story. I place it on the felt tray on his counter. It barely hits the felt before he snaps it up. Lens out, studying it. His eyes flick up to me again, assessing. I'm just a woman. Middle class, well-dressed, late 20s, early 30s. Whatever was worrying him is allayed by my appearance. He squints back at the stone. He calls a colleague over, Martin. Martin gestures a friendly hello. He's younger than the guy in the fleece, who now passes him the stone. His son, perhaps? A nephew? Martin pulls out his own lens and inspects the diamond from all angles. He throws a look to me too, sizes me up. How much you after? Martin's chillier now than his initial hello, businesslike. I suppose that means it's something they want. Game faces are set. I'm not too sure, to be honest. I know it's 2-carat and the cut and color are pretty flawless. I'm guessing around 5 grand. I aim low. Low, low, low. I'm testing the water. I'm pretending I don't know what I've got. I know what I've got. Charles confirmed what we've got before he bowed out. This diamond, like all the others in the pouch, is color D, colorless. Clarity IF, internally flawless. Or VVS1, very, very slightly included. Charles wrote the specs very precisely on the receipt he gave me. A basic round stone with those specs would reach 8 grand per stone wholesale, 9.5 grand with tax. But the stone they hold in their hands now is a radiant cut diamond, rectangular and cut to enhance brilliance and sparkle. These stones are rarer, they're brighter. They come in, wholesale, at around 18 to 20 grand before tax. These guys can't believe their luck. The guy with the fleece juts out his lower lip as if to say, 5 grand seems reasonable. He glances at Martin. What do you think, Martin? Can we stretch? It's a nice stone. He's playing it well. If I didn't know any better, I'd think they were doing me a favor. Martin eyes the stone again before exhaling loudly. He looks at me, his mouth pursed, weighing up the decision.
Yeah, we can do that. Why not? Sure, let's do it.
I'll get it written up. He nods at the fleecy man. Fleecy man smiles over at me, brisk.
You happy with that, love? He asks.
I'm happy in that I've achieved here what I wanted to achieve. These stones can be sold. There are people who will overlook where they might come from if there's a bargain to be made. Even if we let them all go for 5,000 each, That'll still give us a cool million. We could get more than that. I know we could, but a million is fine. Let's not be too greedy. I nod my head sagely, having a think, and I let them stew a moment. That sounds great, guys. Fantastic. I'll have a chat with my husband about it tonight and see what he says, and maybe pop back in tomorrow. I give him a chummy smile. We're all friends here. And pocket my stone. Of course, I have no intention of coming back. I have no intention of selling 200 diamonds one by one at various diamond markets. And as we've learned, the high-end traders won't touch them with a barge pole. So, what we need is to find someone who will look the other way for the right percentage. I think of all the stories Mark's told me over the years about the people he's worked with, the people he's worked for, the things they do, the things they've done. I'm certain we can find somebody. Mark's in the living room when I get home, full of renewed vigor. His business meeting went really well, apparently. Thankfully, most of the industry regulations encourage and support new business. People are setting up their own firms more than ever before, and there's plenty of demand for them in the current climate. He's been working on his potential client list, too. It's looking very healthy, he says with a smile. His luck finally seems to have turned. A rich fug of coffee hangs in the air. He hands me a cup too, a welcome home gift. Any luck with anything? He asks. He leans against the side of the sofa, his arms folded across his chest, with the low light from the setting sun illuminating him. We'll have to turn the lamps on in a minute. It's funny how much we're both enjoying this. It's become a game. Sometimes a game of skill, sometimes a game of chance. Maybe we like it so much because we're winning it right now. I had an idea after I left you, I say tentatively. Bear with me. I went to Hatton Garden. Don't worry, I didn't do anything crazy. I just wanted to test the waters. I wanted to see if there were people who might be willing to look the other way on provenance. And, Mark, there are. There definitely are. I smile at him, feeling my face flush. He doesn't smile back. I persist. What we need is someone just the wrong side of legal to buy them off us, someone who wants the money and isn't worried about where they come from. I try another tentative smile, but he looks back at me blankly. Why isn't he going with me on this? He rises and starts to pace the room, lost in thought. Something's not quite right. I bite my bottom lip and wait. After a moment, he turns and looks at me, his face unreadable. What is it, Mark? What's bothering you? It comes out slightly sharper than I'd expected. He looks away. I guess I can only hold so much in before it starts to seep out. I'm keeping too many secrets right now, the pressure too heavy in my head. We need to sell these diamonds as soon as we can so that we can get back to our real lives. I don't understand why he doesn't see that. We were having so much fun together earlier. I don't understand the sudden withdrawal. He turns back to me. I just can't believe how incredibly Nothing, it's fine. No, you carry on, Erin. He stops and goes to his desk. He busies himself with work papers. How stupid what, Mark? What? I'm sorry if I'm not getting this, but just say what you want to say to me, please. Today has been tough, and I think I've played it pretty well. So if you have a problem with what I'm doing, then could you please tell me? Or better yet, why don't you tell me your ideas, Mark? I demand. He stops what he's doing and looks up at me. Erin, I found DCI Foster's card in the pocket of your other coat. He says this softly. He's not angry. He's disappointed. Which is worse. He didn't think we did things like this. Kept things from each other. I needed change, before you ask. When were you going to tell me about him, Erin? You scared the shit out of me. When did you stop telling me things? He looks at me, hurt in his eyes. First of all, I thought you'd been talking to the police about the bag. I thought you told them everything. I had to Google the guy. Then I saw it was counter-terrorism and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And then I started thinking, is she having an affair with this guy or something? Why does she have his card? And then, like a pathetic moron, I looked through your emails and thank God I saw your email to Phil about yesterday, about Holly. So at least now I know it's just work you're keeping from me, which is fine, Erin, but
Don't freeze me out, okay? I have a right to know what's going on. Keeping secrets, especially about the police at a time like this, that is how things start to go wrong. He frowns at me accusingly. I wasn't going to mention it. I was going to let you get around to telling me in your own time. But I guess we'll just have to talk about it now. So I'm sorry if I'm not completely ecstatic about what you've been up to all day, but I think you can see where I'm coming from, right? You'll be all over CCTV in Hatton Garden. You know that, right? He says this calmly, but his words pound in my head. It's not going to look good if they start to look into you. And it will definitely not look good if DCI Foster finds footage of you. He's right, of course. I'm acting like an idiot. I'm so incredibly screwed if anything goes wrong. Just tell me we're in this together, Erin. You're not keeping anything else from me, are you? It's just you and me, right? It's a serious question that requires a serious answer. I feel the importance of this moment. He's putting himself on the line. I must take him, or I leave him. He's not offering half measures. I still haven't told him about the pregnancy, about Eddie's knowing where we live, knowing everything about us. But I can't tell him now, can I? I'm already on shaky ground. I'm the irresponsible one. I'm the one running around town, risking everything, lying. Imagine if he knew I was doing that while carrying our unborn child. If I tell him now, I might break this fragile thing that we've spent so long creating. He's waiting for my answer. He's genuinely concerned. I feel bad. So bad. I'm sorry, Mark. I'm sorry. I was going to tell you after we'd sold the diamonds. I just didn't want you to worry. And if I genuinely thought that DCI Foster was having me followed, I wouldn't have gone to Hatton Garden, I promise. We really need to get the diamonds out of the house, though. You see that, right? Especially now. He's hurt. I see that, even though he doesn't want me to see that. But after a moment, he nods. He knows we need them gone. I nod back in reply. So, we agree. We need to sell the stones as soon as we can. We need them gone, out of this house. And we need the money in the bank ASAP. It's a question. If he wants me to end all this now, I will end it. I love him too much to push it. He pauses briefly and then nods again. Agreed. I should have told you about DCI Foster. I'm so sorry, Mark. I angle for a half smile and he doesn't let me down. God, I love him. I cross the room to him and put my arms around him. Just don't make a habit of it, Mrs. Roberts. He pulls me close. Let's sell some sodding diamonds then. I press against him, relieved. Do you know anyone who could help us do that? I ask. He looks down at me. Do you? Chapter 27. Wednesday, September the 21st. Alexa's follow-up. They lay her things out on the counter, souvenirs of a life. We stand back and let her look through it all. She signs it out. We pull camera focus to the counter. A Nokia 6100, one of the first mobile phones to have internet connectivity. It was 2002's most desired phone. Alexa was an early adopter. But there's no charger. God knows how she'll ever find one for it now. A mulberry brown leather purse. She opens it. Obsolete Amex cards, notes, coins. I wonder if any of the notes are obsolete now too. The £5 notes changed again last September. They're always changing. I think of all those wallets back there, in the prison storeroom, with £5 notes that are now, or soon will be, utterly worthless. A black collapsible umbrella, half a packet of Wrigley's extra chewing gum, a faded zone 1-2 travel card, and that's it. Alexa's life. Thank you very much. She gives the Trinidadian warden a warm smile. They seem to be getting on well. My pleasure, darling. Now you have a lovely day, and I hope I never have to see you again, if you know what I mean. He gives a throaty laugh and grins back at the beautiful woman before him. Alexa gathers up her belongings into a small cream canvas bag and makes her way towards the exit.
She pauses by the door while the final officer signs her out. Phil, Duncan, and I stand in a cluster behind her. This is the only actual release we've been given the go-ahead to film. Alexa is the only prisoner who has allowed us this much access. We all feel the intimacy of the gesture. We slip out past her, out into the rain. The camera trained back towards her on the doorway as she steps out into the damp autumn air, and the door shuts behind her. She's outside. She looks up, the rain misting her face, the breeze ruffling her hair. She breathes, her chest rising and falling gently. The muffled sound of traffic rumbling past down Camden Road. Wind in the trees. When she finally looks down again, her eyes are wet with tears. She doesn't speak. We all remain silent as we walk backwards in convoy towards the road, filming her. And as we reach the road, a smile bursts bright across her face, and tears start to roll freely down her cheeks. She lifts her head and laughs. It's contagious. We're all smiling now. In the great gaping chasm of Alexa's new freedom, our plan must come as a welcome guide rail. We're off to Waterloo Station, where Alexa will be getting the train down to Folkestone and Kent, her new home, her family home. We're traveling down there together, and we'll be filming her on and off for the next 2 days. It's a relief to be getting away from London for a night. I keep expecting Andy to burst through the door at any moment. It's unbelievably exhausting, the diamonds burning a hole through our attic floor like Poe's telltale heart. This trip will take my mind off that. It will focus me. I booked a car to take us to the station, but first Alexa wants to walk for a bit, so we walk in the light rain. She stops at a cafe to buy a freshly squeezed orange juice. We all stand and watch the bright orange crescents turn through the juicing machine and press into liquid. She sips it through a straw. She nods. "It's good," she smiles. She buys three more, one for each of us, using some of her 14-year-old legal tender, and we walk on. We stop at Caledonian Park, where she finds a wet bench to sit on, and we pull back, out of her sightline as she looks at the trees, the skyline, dog walkers, joggers. She takes it all in. Finally, she breaks the silence. She turns back towards us. "Can we stop for a minute, guys? Come, sit with me." She pats the rain-darkened bench. We're an odd sight, the four of us, all side by side on the park bench. Slender Alexa, stocky Glaswegian Duncan on sound, Steadicam operator Phil, and me. We all look out ahead, across the drizzly park. Phil still filming our view, the camera resting on his lap. "Thank you for being here," Alexa says as we stare out at a grey London. "This is the best day of my life." And yes, we captured the audio. Thankfully, our train's not too busy. We catch moments where we can along the journey. Alexa's first newspaper, Alexa's first G&T, Alexa's first bar of chocolate. And then on to the quiet village of Hawking, where Alexa's father, David, stands waiting in his driveway. She fumbles at the door handle of the taxi, finds it, and springs out into the Kent countryside. Father and daughter run to each other, the ruddy-faced 70-year-old enveloping his daughter in a bear hug. They cling together. "Home now," he says, like a promise. "Home safe." He squeezes her hard. Finally, David turns back towards us, Alexa's head fitting perfectly in the crook of his arm, both beaming. "Come on then, you lot. Let's get some hot tea in you." He motions to the house and shepherds us inside, Phil still filming, bringing up the rear. We leave them to it as the light starts to fade and make our way to the glamorous lights of Folkestone and the Premier Inn where we'll be sleeping tonight. Nothing's Premier here except the prices. The soap is antibacterial foam that comes out of a wall dispenser. I call Mark, almost reluctantly. I feel so awful about hurting him yesterday, but he'll be worried, so I force myself to call. Mark tells me that he's had some terrific news about the business. A potential client has got in touch today. He'd heard about Mark's new firm through a colleague, and he said he'd be looking to move over to Mark once he's up and running. Plus, Hector has confirmed he's definitely going to move companies. He's delighted to be joining Mark. It's going to be a new start for both of them. I'm so glad he's decided to take matters into his own hands. He's had no new ideas about the diamonds. He's been too busy. I tell him we'll work something out. We always do. We just need to hold tight. I just need to finish here with Alexa and get through Eddie's filming on Saturday. Then we'll have time to work something out. This new company is a real lifeline for Mark. The job market is dead right now, and I really don't know what he would have done without this. I kiss him goodnight down the phone and go to sleep on my rock-hard bed, smiling like an idiot. Alexa's fertility clinic appointment is at 10:35 the next morning back in London. It seems funny that since we last spoke about getting pregnant, I am pregnant. My secret passenger will be joining us on our visit. Alexa is quiet this morning, nervous, her hands tightly clasped as we sit in the Lister Hospital's waiting room. We have permission to film today's doctor's appointment. I've done some reading around fertility, but I have no idea what to expect, really. After a certain amount of reshuffling, we all manage to squeeze ourselves and the filming equipment into the small consultancy room. Dr. Prahani, a well-groomed doctor in her 40s with a reassuringly serious smile, offers Alexa a seat. She folds her manicured hands and rests them lightly over Alexa's paperwork, which covers her desk. Now, the main aim of our consultation today is to ascertain whether you actually need IVF treatment or if we can proceed with the less invasive method of insemination, IUI for short. IUI is much simpler than IVF. It's the process of selecting the best sperm from your selected donor sample in the lab and then introducing that sample directly to your uterus via a catheter. It would be a very minimal, non-invasive process, which we could do for you in about 5 minutes. Obviously, that would be our preferred method. Alexa raises her eyebrows hopefully and nods in hypothetical agreement. The tests are easy and surprisingly quick. A vial of blood is taken, then the curtain around the bed is drawn, and Phil, Duncan, and I watch the extra monitor as it shows grainy black and white footage of Alexa's uterus. It's funny how little we all know about fertility, pregnancy. It's the single most important subject for the whole of humanity, and yet I feel like I'm trying to read Urdu. Her egg count is good. Alexa's body softens in relief. They'll need to get her AMH levels back from the blood work tomorrow to be sure, but it looks very promising so far. We hug outside the clinic. I've somehow slipped from professional to personal with her. It's been an emotional 2 days. Alexa jokes that she'd like to keep Duncan as her emotional support animal. I laugh. She's funny. And Duncan does have a pretty outdoorsy beard these days. I arranged to Skype her off the record tomorrow night once she's back in Kent, see how she's doing. It's strange. I feel like I know her, really know her, and I feel like she might know me. She falls somewhere between my old life and this new one I'm creating. Alexa seems more alive than anyone I've ever met, and suddenly I realize I care very much what happens to her next. Chapter 28, Friday, September the 23rd, AM. Strange things. When I got home yesterday, Mark was working in his study. He stopped when I came in and we went and sat in the kitchen together. We'd been given tea bags and biscuits from Fortnum & Mason as a wedding gift, so I made us a pot. He only managed a few sips and a bite of orange rind biscuit. I don't know why, but being away from him, even for a night, made me desperate for him. I led him upstairs and we made love as the daylight faded. Perhaps it's all these new hormones, that and the fact that we hadn't slept together since Geneva 5 days previous. As I said before, disgusting as it may seem, that's a long time for us. I needed it. I hadn't known I'd needed it, but I did. After, as we lay tangled together on the sheets, I thought about telling him, about our baby, but I couldn't seem to form the words. I didn't want to spoil the moment. I didn't want him to stop me trying to do what I need to do. It's still early days. The pregnancy might come to nothing. Anyway, I've made a promise to myself. I will go to the doctor, and I will tell Mark everything as soon as the diamonds are out of our house and we're safe. In preparation for Eddie's interview tomorrow, I was called to Pentonville Prison at 7:45 this morning. It's been a week of early starts. As Pentonville is a male facility, I've been told there are a few slightly different angles I need to be aware of, as I can now imagine. For example, I've been told to wear trousers tomorrow. That sort of thing. Best not to analyze it. After a lot of listening, nodding, and paper signing, I make it out of the final security door and back into the icy wind on Roman Road. I wrap myself up in my coat, winding my scarf tight, trying to remember where I need to be next, when a voice behind me calls out, "Excuse me, hello?" I pivot back towards the gates to see a friendly-looking man in a suit jogging towards me. "Sorry, one second, sorry to slow you down there," he huffs, ruddy-cheeked in the cold, his hand extended. "Patrick." I take his hand in mine. I don't think we've met before. "Aaron Roberts," I say. Patrick beams back at me, a firm grip, my warm hand in his cold one. "Yes, yes, Miss Roberts, of course," he says, catching his breath. He gestures back to the prison building. "Did I forget something?" I prompt. "Sorry. Yes, I was just wondering exactly what you were doing here today, Miss Roberts. I saw your name in the register, but I think there's been some confusion in administration, and for some reason I think I've been cut out of the loop." He looks embarrassed. "Oh, God, sorry. Yes, I was visiting the warden, Alison Butler, about the Eddie Bishop interview tomorrow." His eyes flare with understanding. "Right, yes, of course. The interview. And you're a reporter, aren't you?" He looks at me suspiciously. Oh, great. The last thing I need right now is for them to revoke the filming permission. People warned me Pentonville would be a pain in the arse, and this has been plain sailing up until now. "No, no, it's for the documentary, the prisoner documentary. We got the permissions late last year. Should I maybe email the info to you, Patrick? Alison has it already, I'm pretty sure." I can hear a hint of disbelief at the situation in my own voice. I mean, I don't want to piss him off, but they should really be on top of this. I mean, it's a prison, for God's sake. They should bloody well know who's coming and going, seriously. I think of Holly, and suddenly her breaking parole doesn't seem quite so implausible. He catches my tone, but doesn't seem offended. If anything, he's apologetic. "Ah, I see, right. That'll be it. My office has been having some issues with the visitor logins, but that's by the by. I'm so sorry, Miss Roberts. We'll make sure that we're all on the same page for next week. What day did you say it was?" He squints at me in the cold September light. "It's tomorrow, not next week. Saturday the 24th. Eddie Bishop?" I say it slowly and clearly. Patrick smiles and nods. "Perfect. I guess we'll see you then. Sorry about the confusion, Aaron." He shakes my hand again and heads back towards the prison. I turn and start to walk away. Should I send a confirmation email to him once I get home? Just in case. That way I'm definitely covered, right? There'll be a paper trail. And then I realize I don't know his surname. I turn to catch him, but he's no longer there. Disappeared back into the bowels of Pentonville. Damn. Patrick Watt. I run the conversation through in my mind. He didn't mention his surname, did he? And then a doubt suddenly flickers in my mind. I remember how cold his hand was in mine. His cold hand in my hot one. He didn't come out of the prison, did he? If he had, then his hands would have been warm like mine. But why would he pretend to be coming out of the prison? And then it hits me. He knows my name, and what I do, and where I'll be tomorrow. Who the hell was he? I head back to the prison gates and buzz in. A voice comes loud over the intercom.
"Hello?"
"Hi there, did Patrick just come back in?"
"Who?"
"Patrick."
"Patrick who?"
I don't know, Patrick, I don't know his last name," I stammer. Better to be honest.
Right, sorry, who is this?"
"It's Aaron Roberts, I was just here." I try not to sound too desperate, but I'm keenly aware that I sound fully deranged about now.
"Oh, yeah, you just signed out. Sorry, what's the problem?"
The guard sounds cheerier now. He remembers me. I didn't look crazy a minute ago. No, there's no problem. It's just... has anyone come through since I left?" There's a second's silence. I suppose he's weighing up whether I am crazy after all. Either that or he's thinking about lying.
No, ma'am, just you. Should I get someone to come out to help you?
He asks tentatively. He's popped out a ma'am now. Shit. I'm being handled. I need to go before this escalates.
No, no, I'm fine. Thank you.
I leave it at that. Patrick doesn't work for the prison. And if Patrick doesn't work for the prison, who the hell does Patrick work for? He wanted my name, and he wanted to find out why I was here. A cold, nasty thought forms in my head. Does Patrick want his bag back? When I get home, something is not quite right. The house is empty, and when I walk into the kitchen, an icy breeze is blowing in through the slightly ajar back door. It's open. Mark would never leave the back door open. Someone else has left the back door open. Someone else has been in here, and might still be in here. I stand there for a second, frozen in disbelief, unwilling to accept the implications of what this means. I sense something shifting in the corner of the room behind me. I spin around, but of course there's no one there. Just the fridge clicking on in my silent, empty house. Room by room, I check. I nudge open doors, bursting in, Mark's cricket bat in hand, for all the good a cricket bat will do me. My adrenaline is off the charts as it pounds through my system. Room by room, I search for someone, or something, evidence that someone was here. I scan for anything missing, anything disturbed. Nothing obvious stands out. Finally, once I've checked the whole house is empty, I make my way onto the landing and pull down the attic ladder. I need to check under the insulation. As I ascend, a simple sentence repeats over and over in my head. Please don't be gone. Please don't be gone. But as I approach the loose section where the diamonds are hidden, the mantra shifts, without a second thought, to please be gone. Please be gone. Because if the diamonds are gone, then whoever came in through our back door has no reason to come back again. Unless, that is, they want their money back too. Under the dry insulation, everything remains as it was. The diamonds sit sparkling in their warm pouch, the phone and the USB still safely tucked in its casing. We weren't robbed. Whoever broke in was checking up on us, not stealing. But the seed of doubt is now firmly planted in my mind. Perhaps I'm missing something. I search the whole house again, every room. I look harder this time, searching for any signs of interference, any possible clues as to who has been here. And then I see it. In our bedroom, on the mantelpiece of our Georgian fireplace, next to our concert tickets and our antique clock, there's an empty space. An empty rectangular shape left on the mantel dust. Our photo. Gone. A photo taken the day of our engagement, us smiling into the camera, Mark and me. Someone has stolen a photo of Mark and me. And that's all they took. Down in the living room, the answer phone's red message light is flashing. 5 messages. I sit in silence and listen. The most recent is from Alexa. She's been given the go-ahead for the IUI. It's good news. Her appointment is next week. The answering machine segues into the next message. At first, I think it must be a pocket dial. I hear the sounds of some unknown location, muffled background noises, the occasional snippet of barely audible conversation, the low hum of a large, busy place, a station, perhaps, an airport. The phone is on the move. I wonder if maybe I pocket dialed myself at Waterloo. The call came on Wednesday when we were on our way to Folkestone. I listen harder for our voices, ghosts from the past. But I can't hear us. I listen to the whole message, 2.5 minutes of muffled life, somewhere, until the line finally clicks out. I stare at the answer machine. There's nothing that strange about a pocket dial, really, is there? I mean, they happen all the time, don't they? But they do feel eerie, even at the best of times, like gateways back through life. Or maybe not. Maybe I'm just creeping myself out. The next message starts, and things get really weird. It's the same. Well, almost. I know what you're thinking. That's perfectly normal. Whoever pocket dialed the first time must have just kept leaning on the same button. But the second message is from the next day. At the same time, exactly. 11:03. I was in the clinic then with Alexa and the crew. My phone was off. So it definitely can't have been me pocket dialing myself. This call is different. It's outdoors, a park maybe. The gentle whistle of breeze over the receiver, the occasional shriek of kids in a playground. The caller is walking. At a minute in, I hear the rattle of an overground train. Or it could just be a train. Nothing tells me this call was made from London but my own mind. The walker reaches a road, the sound of cars passing, and then the line clicks out again. Why would someone call 2 days in a row at exactly 11:03 and not speak? Why indeed? They could still be pocket dials, of course, but they're not, are they? Someone is checking to see if we're in. The next message begins. Left at 8:42 this morning, while I was in my meeting with Alison Butler, the warden at Pentonville. This one is quieter, indoors, a cafe perhaps. I think I can just about make out the clink of cutlery on plates, the mumble of conversation in the background. Breakfast for someone. I strain to hear more, a snatch of context. And then it comes, a voice, not the caller, but someone speaking to the caller. It's so soft I might have missed it if I weren't listening so hard.
Are you still waiting? Shall I come back in a moment?
The caller gives a low mumble of assent, and the rest is just background noise. So I know that this morning whoever called me was waiting for someone to meet them. At around 8:45 in a restaurant somewhere in London, judging by the waiter's accent. But it's the final message, at 9:45 today, that scares me the most. It's inside again, the low hum of something electrical, an industrial freezer, cold storage, something like that, muffled conversation in the background again, an irregular electrical beeping, people shuffling about, and then suddenly, a noise I recognize. A noise that I know very, very well. It cuts through all the other background noises. The automatic two-tone beep bleep of our newsagent's door when it opens. This call was made from inside our newsagent's. It's just around the corner from our house. A tingle runs straight down my spine and I have to sit down hard on the study chair. I got home about 15 minutes after that message was made. Whoever left that message was here. I think about calling Mark, calling the police maybe. But what on earth would I tell them? Everything? I'd have to. No, I can't do that. I guarantee that Mark hasn't got any idea that these messages exist. He never checks the house phone. He never even gives anyone this number. It's essentially my work number. I think of Patrick's cold hand in mine. Number unknown. Could Patrick have come here after he left me? Or did he come here before going to Pentonville? Is that how he knew what I looked like? But why would he come back here after meeting me? Or maybe Patrick was only supposed to hold me up, while whoever was in the house could do what they needed to do. I sit in the fading afternoon light and listen to the messages again, straining to catch a hint of anything I may have missed. I try to remember Patrick's face. His hair, his clothes. Oh, God. It's funny how little we pick up, isn't it? There's nothing I can cling to. Middle-aged, a suit, a firm handshake. His voice, British, with a hint of something else. French? European of some sort? I want to cry. I'm such an idiot. Why didn't I pay more attention? I guess the situation was distracting. I wanted to smooth the transaction, so I didn't really look. What did he want? To show himself? To scare me? Or maybe to find out my connection to the prison, if I was visiting anyone else inside. Could this be about Eddie? Maybe that's it. Maybe it's nothing to do with the bag at all. Maybe it's something to do with Holly. Holly and SO15. When Mark gets home, I know I have to tell him everything. Chapter 29, Friday, September 23rd, PM.
strange people. I tell Mark almost everything. He takes it all in, calmly, nodding me on. I tell him about Patrick, about the calls. He checks his own phone to check it wasn't him pocket dialing. I tell him about the open door, about the missing photo. I hold back on my suspicions about Eddie. I know he'll stop me going to the interview tomorrow if I tell him about how Eddie knew where we were from the other side of the world, how he may be monitoring my every move. I don't want Mark to stop that interview. I don't tell him about the pregnancy, either. Once I tell him that news, I'll have to stop it all. The documentary, the diamonds, everything. He'll want me to stop it all. When I finish talking, he leans back against the sofa, arms folded across his chest. He takes a long beat before speaking. All right, here's how I see it. First of all, that photo is in the study. I scanned it the other day for Mum, so that explains that. Oh my God, Mark. No one took the photo. He gives me an amused grin and I feel my cheeks flush with colour. Oh my God, how embarrassing. I slump my head down into my hands. What a paranoid idiot. And suddenly, I'm not so sure how much of this situation is real at all. How much is just adrenaline-based fabrication? Mark snorts a chuckle before continuing. Yeah, the picture is safe. Second, I'm not sure we should read too much into forgetting to lock the back door. You know, the mind does funny stuff when we're stressed out. But having said that, I think the guy you met today does sound like he could be a serious issue. I think you're right to be concerned about that. I mean, my initial thought, obviously, is that Patrick's connected to DCI Foster and the SO15 investigation with Holly. Don't you think? I mean, that's the only logical explanation, really. He's been following you, and he's seen you at Pentonville Prison a day before you should be there for your big interview, so he decides to intervene and ask you some questions. That makes sense. He wouldn't know Pentonville called you in a day earlier for that meeting. You only found out last night. I'd say that's it. It makes sense, what he's saying, but I can't quite shake the feeling that this is something else entirely. But why wouldn't he introduce himself as police, Mark? And what about the answer phone messages? Do the police leave weird answer phone messages? Listen, I know you think it's the plain people, but think about it logically, Erin. If it was the plain people, if they knew where you were, do you think we'd still be here? Do you think the stuff in the attic would still be here? He lets the question hang in the still air. I shake my head. No, I don't think we would be, I answer slowly, realizing the truth of it as I say it out loud. He continues briskly. I don't know why he didn't say. I guess he hoped you'd believe he worked for the prison like he said. I mean, he was undercover, right? And the messages? They could be a prank. I don't know, pocket dials? And I mean, come on, you know that's not really our news agent, right? Most of the corner shops in London have that noise. I really don't think someone is threatening us via door noise. Perhaps it's something to do with one of your interviewees. I mean, that's definitely a possibility, right? I think of Eddie again, and the champagne. Yes, it's definitely a possibility. Maybe Eddie needs to speak to me. But how could he be calling from an unknown number from prison? They wouldn't agree to let him have his own phone in prison. And then it hits me. Eddie is a criminal. Of course he has a way to call me. I remember reading about the methods gang members use to get burner phones smuggled into prison. It's certainly not a comfortable process for the smuggler, but they are handsomely rewarded for their troubles, or at the very least not murdered in their beds. It could definitely be Eddie leaving me those messages. Erin, you need to focus on the real situation here. The man you spoke to today, Patrick. Let's say SO15 is doing some checking up on you. Forget the missing photo and our back door. The photo's fine, and as far as the door goes, well, sometimes we just forget to lock things. Mark, I don't forget to lock things. I interrupt, but I feel my conviction flagging. Yeah, you do, Erin. He studies me for a second, frowning, surprised. Sorry, honey, but you have definitely done that before. You know that door blows open if it's not locked properly. Trust me, you've forgotten to lock it before.
Have I? That door does blow open if it's not locked, he's right. How could I know that unless I'd seen it do that? I guess I must have left it unlocked at some point. And then I think of our photo. It probably hasn't been in our room for days. I didn't notice that it was